Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, history professor Kirsten Swinth discusses the battle over the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s and 80s. The Equal Rights Amendment was a proposed amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would guarantee certain rights for women. It passed Congress, but was not ratified by the required number of state legislatures. This hour-long class took place at Fordham University in the Bronx, New York.
Hi, welcome. Good morning. So today we're going to be talking about the battle over the Equal Rights Amendment that took place over the course of the 1970s. Nearly 50 years after it was first introduced into Congress, the Equal Rights Amendment was passed by both houses of the Congress in March 1972. It simply read in the way that it had been written even 50 years before, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." Hawaii, who had legislators waiting by the phone for the ratification by Congress, passed the ERA the same day. On the second day, Delaware, Nebraska, and New Hampshire ratified the ERA. On the third day, so too did Idaho and Iowa. 22 of the 38 states necessary ratified the Equal Rights Amendment in rapid succession before the end of the year. And support for the Equal Rights Amendment spanned the political spectrum. The Equal Rights Amendment in 1972 seemed unstoppable. Why? Why something that had been waiting around for 50 years did it seem suddenly the moment for it? The burgeoning feminist movement had thrown its weight behind the Equal Rights Amendment, and this was a fundamental shift from earlier feminist positions. Most women's activists through the 1960s opposed the Equal Rights Amendment, fearing that it would erode labor laws that they cherished. Remember, we talked about the importance of protective labor legislation to the early women's rights movement. They had fought for minimum wage laws, maximum hours laws, laws providing weightlifting restrictions, for example, for women. But by the mid-1960s, these protective labor laws seemed less and less relevant. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 had provided for the end to sex discrimination against women, and then the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, which was came out of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, had ruled in 1970 that protective labor laws were invalid. So historic feminist opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment began to fade. And the new women's rights movement made the Equal Rights Amendment an early priority. Here we have the National Organization for Women's Bill of Rights, which was passed in 1968. And you can see that its very, very first priority is an equal rights constitutional amendment. The unified women's movement then mobilized broad support for the amendment. So we had feminists and labor unions jumping on the board of the ERA, but so too did mainstream women's organizations like the League of Women Voters, United Church Women, the Young Women's Christian Association, the YWCA, and the American Association of University Women. So you have this just sort of broad-based, very deep mass support for the Equal Rights Amendment. And in fact, 1972, when the ERA was passed in Congress, was high tide of the women's liberation movement. Not only did the Equal Rights Amendment come out of Congress in 1972, but so too did Title IX of the Higher Education Act. Title IX, if any of you play sports, did any of you play sports when you're women? Not any of the women in this room play sports when they were growing up. That's a legacy of Title IX. Title IX mandated equality in any educational programs that received federal funding, and that included sports, that included access to a whole array of educational opportunities for women. But 1972 was also a year in which Congress passed a tax break for childcare for working parents. Women's activists drafted legislation for the Women's Education Equity Act. Congressional hearings on equal credit were flooded by women protesting the discrimination they faced in credit. Representative Bella Abzug, who was from New York, remembered that 1972 was a watershed year, she called it. She said the mood in Congress in that year was, who'd be against women's rights? And they just kept inserting no sex discrimination in legislation after legislation after legislation. So the ERA, at that watershed moment, seemed unstoppable. Yet it would stall out. In 1973, 8 more states did ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. But after that, state ratification slowed to a crawl. And you have a map there of the states that ratified the ERA, states that didn't, and then states that later withdrew their ratification. So in the 4 years after 1973, only 5 more states would ratify it, and then it would essentially stop. In 1979, Congress added a 3-year extension for the period in which the amendment could be ratified, but no other states after that approved it, and 5 states rescinded their initial endorsement. In 1982, the amendment was dead. An enormously successful anti-equal rights amendment campaign turned key votes against the amendment. So why? So our question today, the kind of question we're struggling with to try to answer is, why did the ERA, when it had such widespread popular support, fail? By what way can we possibly explain that? Now here's a table that shows us, for example, the extensive support that even at the end of the decade-long ratification campaign the ERA had. So this chart shows by sex and race and income and so on, education, religion. We see here vast majorities, 3/4 in some cases, of the population supporting endorsement of the Equal Rights Amendment. And yet, in spite of that broad popular support, in spite of the broad political movement behind it, the Equal Rights Amendment failed. To answer the question of why it failed, we need to think about a couple of things. Most broadly, the Equal Rights Amendment failed over conflict over changing gender roles in a changing economy. So while the country was ready to accept the concept of equal rights, as in equal rights in the workplace, they were not prepared to radically alter gender roles. So in the biggest sense, the Equal Rights Amendment was, the struggle over the Equal Rights Amendment was played out on this ground, on the grounds of rights versus roles. Was the Equal Rights Amendment about rights, about women's fundamental equal rights, or was the Equal Rights Amendment about women's roles, about the kinds of roles they would play in society and in the family? Even more specifically, as that question of roles came to the forefront in the battle over the Equal Rights Amendment, the struggle over the ERA was a battle over the fate of the housewife amid the realities of a new economy. And I'll get to that over the course of the lecture. So, let's begin to think about the opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment. The Equal Rights Amendment was still tied up in the Senate when Phyllis Schlafly unleashed her first broadside against it in February 1972. And in fact, you read that for today in the Phyllis Schlafly report. Schlafly called the Equal Rights Amendment a fraud, and she declared that American women were more privileged than any other in the history of the world. Why should we lower ourselves to equal rights when we already have the status of special privilege, she demanded. So Schlafly claimed that a host of dangers awaited passage of the Equal Rights Amendment: destruction of the family, forced employment of mothers, dreary state-run childcare, and daughters drafted into the army. Schlafly's charges Remember, this is February 1972, actually before the amendment has even made its way through Congress. But still, Schlafly's charges hit a nerve. And over the next decade, she catapulted to national prominence, leading the opposition forces to the amendment. Schlafly was a conservative grassroots Republican activist. She was a highly educated woman. She had an MA in political science from Radcliffe, and she would later go on to earn a law degree. She'd been involved in Republican Party politics since the 1950s. In fact, in 1952, she made an unsuccessful run for Congress while she was already a married mother, and in spite of her duties to her family. She was also a leader in the Republican, in the National Federation of Republican Women. Now, for most of her 1950s and 1960s political activism, Schlafly concentrated on anti-communism. These were very traditional concerns for conservative activists in this period. So she focused on opposition to communism. She focused on SALT treaties, which were arms limitation treaties. And she had actually paid little to no attention to women's rights, nor thought particularly about the Equal Rights Amendment until 1971, when a friend asked her to take part in a debate against the amendment. So she was actually drawn into the question of women's rights, not out of her own instinctive interests or background in organizing, but through sheer coincidence when a friend asked her to speak in a debate. That debate crystallized Schlafly's opposition, and she concluded that the Equal Rights Amendment must be stopped because it threatened principles of family and gender roles that she believed were sacrosanct. Now, Schlafly herself seemed to embody liberated womanhood, but fundamentally her beliefs were quite different. She believed that women should work hard, but to help their families. And she said it was fine for women to be both housewives and have careers as long as they could manage it as individuals. They could still take care of their children and manage their careers. Husbands, she thought, were the natural head of the family, and their needs as well as the needs of children came first. Now, Schlafly's outlook about women's roles tapped into a broader base of activism by conservative women. Now, here I have a slide specifically of anti-equal rights amendment activism, but I'm using it just to illustrate this sort of broader base of women's conservative activism. Women had actually been conservative activists for decades. Women were involved in the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s, for example. And even in the 1950s, in the period where the domestic ideal was most in force in American society, conservative women had been activists at the grassroots levels. So they had organized, for example, out of their own homes and kitchens, networks of activists involved in militant anti-communism crusades. For example, tracking down Reds in local government or making sure that no communist ideas spread in schools or churches or communities. Now, these are the women who would then be mobilized both by the Equal Rights Amendment and by the Roe v. Wade decision in January 1973, which legalized abortion. So let's stop for just a minute, because you did that reading in Kristen Luker's book about the women who were mobilized by Roe v. Wade to become pro-life activists. And their backgrounds were very much the same as the backgrounds of women who joined the anti-ERA protests. So thinking about Luker, can you tell me a little bit about who got drawn into the pro-life movement? What were their social backgrounds? What were some of their traits? Yeah, Marissa.
The majority of them identified as religious.
Okay, so they
particularly as Catholic.
Okay, so they identified as religious and initially as Catholic. That's initially in the early stages of the pro-life movement as Catholic. What else can you tell me about their backgrounds? Yeah.
The white middle class women.
They were white, largely. They were largely middle class. What else would you say about them?
and comments that 63% of them didn't work.
63% of them didn't work. So large majorities of them were housewives, Mary Elena?
It said that they had little to no college education.
Little to no college education. So just to, so we get the sense of the contrast. Give me a quick sense of who the pro-choice activists that Kristen Luker studied were. This is actually parallels the pro-ERA forces as well. What were contrast them for me briefly? What were the characteristics of the pro-ERA pro-choice activists? Yeah, go ahead.
Often young, single, independent women.
They were independent, sometimes young and single, sometimes married, but in any case, they were professionally oriented, career oriented. What else could you say about them? Yeah, Kendall.
Well, it says the average pro-choice activist is a 44-year-old married woman who grew up in a large metropolitan area and whose father was a college graduate. So she came from like an educated.
Okay, so in college education, coming from a metropolitan area. Yeah, Stella.
She also married later and had fewer children.
Married later and had fewer children. Kendall, do you want anything else?
She mentions that she's not religiously active.
And not particularly religiously active. Okay, so on the one side we have educated professional women. On the other side we have women who are relatively less educated, although still middle class, whose lives are built around being housewives and child rearing. It's in this context that Luker makes the point that motherhood had very different meanings for these different groups of women, and that for those who were in the pro-choice movement and for those, the pro-life movement and those who would go on to be in, as well in the anti-ERA movement, homemaking and mothering was very much at the center of their identities. This is an interesting chart. It actually shows us still a majority of Americans still in 1982 supporting the Equal Rights Amendment. But I wanted you to see in this the ways the numbers start to drop off by certain kinds of categories. So for example, where we were talking about above 70% when we looked at the previous slide, now we're talking about 61% for fundamentalist Protestants. Very active churchgoers. We got the only time we hit a minority of people supporting the Equal Rights Amendment. And you can see, I noticed the difference with the number of children, how large numbers of children changed the level of support for the Equal Rights Amendment. And finally, I wanted you to look down at the bottom to contrast how in rural areas as opposed to in cities, there was a sort of, about a 13-point gap in support for the Equal Rights Amendment. And similarly, if you compare the coasts, the East and West coasts to the South, we're talking there about a 14-point gap with much more support along the coasts of the United States. And in fact, it was in southern states, Midwestern and southern states, where Equal Rights Amendment ratification ran into the greatest obstacles. So despite the success of the women's movement, many women in America remain suspicious of the image of an independent, liberated woman. And many housewives viewed their roles as housewives as more satisfying than any kind of likely alternative, such as service or factory employment. And these concerned women already had a network of activist conservative women to tap into when they were mobilized by the Equal Rights Amendment fight. Phyllis Schlafly began mobilizing anti-ERA activism in September 1972 when she brought more than 100 women together in St. Louis, Missouri to map out an anti-ERA strategy. Stop ERA was born out of this organizing conference. And you can't, images, as you've already seen, you can't escape images of this stop sign with Stop ERA on it. Stop, by the way, in this case, was an acronym for Stop Taking Our Privileges. So Stop Taking Our Privileges against the ERA. These Stop ERA signs were ubiquitous. You could find them all around the country within months of this September 1972 organizing conference. By early 1973, Stop ERA chapters had been organized in 26 states. Schlafly ran a very well-oiled campaign. She had what might be considered a very effective political machine. In Illinois, for example, her home base, Schlafly could mobilize 20,000 supporters through a phone tree. She would get those women then to gather at the Illinois legislature within days, and they would come. This was a standard tactic of Stop ERA. They would come to go and flood legislators' offices, and they would arrive carrying homemade bread and jam and pies and a variety of other things. And they would carry signs that said, "From the bread makers to the bread winners." And I'm for mom and apple pie. So they played off of their roles as homemakers to appeal to the largely male legislators. Now, the Stop ERA campaign was enormously effective in raising doubts about what had seemed like an obvious case for the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, the opponents challenged the ERA on several grounds. I'm just going to use this slide to show you sort of some of the basic premises of opponents and proponents of the ERA. And these are classic kind of campaign buttons from the Equal Rights Amendment campaign. And people would wear them. You could find them all over. So those on the Stop ERA side said that the problem with the Equal Rights Amendment was that it meant women could be drafted and potentially even required to serve in combat. This was a particularly potent argument made by ERA opponents. It spoke to broad opposition to women serving in the military, and good portions of this argument were made during a time when America was still fighting the war in Vietnam, and certainly the war would have been fresh in the country's memory throughout the period. Opponents also raised the specter of drastic consequences with the Equal Rights Amendment that would essentially like turn the world topsy-turvy. So they said the ERA would require unisex bathrooms, unisex dormitories, unisex prisons. And you saw some of the signs of that on one of the earlier slides. And finally, ERA opponents claimed that the amendment would violate states' rights. States had traditionally, for example, had control over family law. And so they opposed the ERA on the grounds that it was an expansion, an unjustified expansion of federal authority. Now, proponents countered with their own ERA Yes campaign, and they cited a variety of things. Probably the strongest argument that was made by ERA proponents, this is a flyer from a pro-ERA flyer. You can see it's a little wordy in the older, less graphic era in some ways. So one of the most important and kind of strongest arguments made by ERA proponents was what they called the 59-cent campaign. And they argued that the Equal Rights Amendment would be very important to equalizing wages between men and women. And 59 cents was the average women's earnings on the dollar to men's earnings. So women earned 59 cents for every dollar that men earned. So you could see, in addition to ERA Yes buttons, you could see these buttons saying 59 cents as a symbol of that. The proponents of the ERA also argued that the amendment would remove important legal disabilities that women still faced in 1972. So the amendment would invalidate laws that discriminated against women in things like jury service, for example, or by setting quotas for admissions to educational programs, or by allowing for different criminal penalties for men and women in differing situations. Now, over the course of the 1970s, these arguments about legal disabilities that women faced became less and less relevant because of a number of Supreme Court rulings after the ERA came out of Congress, which essentially invalidated many of those laws in any case. So today, for example, much of the basis of women's legal equality comes from those Supreme Court rulings in the 1970s, even though the ERA itself was never passed. One of the most fundamental points of contention between the two sides, however, was the fate of the housewife. Who'd have thought, right, the housewife would be such a focus of discretion. The housewife essentially would disappear under the Equal Rights Amendment, conservatives argued. And housewives, they said, were the emblem of American womanhood. And this is the argument that Phyllis Schlafly puts forward in her kind of second big strike against the Equal Rights Amendment. In the article that you read from November 1972 in the Phyllis Schlafly report, where she talks about the right to be a woman. So I want to stop here for just a minute and talk about what are some of the things that Schlafly says when she talks about the right to be a woman. So from her perspective, what is the right to be a woman, and what are some of the components of those rights? Yeah, Francesca.
She wrote about the perks that come along with being a wife, not having to worry about financial issues, to be allowed to collect child care and alimony, I guess, if she were to be in a divorce. Certain perks that wouldn't necessarily be there if they would have rights in the eyes of the government.
Okay. What else can you say about it? So rights that you accrued as a married woman. Elaborate a little bit more on that. What kinds of things? You got child at divorce, alimony, and child support. What else? Yeah, Ellen.
Well, she said that the main thing that made them different from men was the fact that they could have babies and that they should, I guess, embrace that instead of, I guess, keep complaining about it, which I guess she thought a lot of the ERA women were doing.
Okay, all right. So embracing your fundamental identity as a mother and embracing difference between women and men. Anything else that you can tell me about her ideas about the right to be a woman? Go ahead, Francesca.
She talked about the duty of the man, which I guess goes hand in hand with the right of the woman that, you know, in Section 329, one of the most fundamental duties imposed by the law of domestic relations is that it requires a man to support his wife and family. I mean, that in a sense is the opposite of what a right of a woman, of the role of a woman would be in her eyes.
Right, to have a woman not supported by a man. Yeah. So from her perspective, one of the most fundamental rights you had as a woman was the right to be supported by a man, the right not to have to work, the right to be a dependent economically in order to be a full-time wife and mother. So the dangerous specter of the Equal Rights Amendment, as far as Schlafly was concerned, was the ways that it eroded that right to receive support. And in fact, Schlafly implied that once you withdrew laws that were on the books that mandated spousal support for wives, women could even be forced to provide 50% of the financial support for a household. So from her perspective, the Equal Rights Amendment was a kind of radical revolution in, or would lead to a radical revolution in basic household responsibilities, and would erode the basic protections that she saw as essential to protecting women's fundamental identities as wives and homemakers. And in fact, just the way that Francesca was pointing out, Schlafly labeled the Equal Rights Amendment the Men's Liberation Amendment, because she argued argued that it would benefit men more in the end than it would ever benefit women by relieving them of their obligations to wives and children and to divorce spouses without really offering women any counterbalancing protections. Now, Phyllis Schlafly's arguments about the threats of the Equal Rights Amendment to women's right to be a woman, to women's right to be a housewife and a homemaker, were picked up widely in the anti-Equal Rights Amendment movement. One prominent example of this is infamously known as the Pink Sheet, because it was printed on pink paper. And it was spread by an organization called Women Who Want to Be Women, www, the four W's. And they distributed this all across the South in churches, in PTAs, and all kinds of community networks. They published it in small town local newspapers. And it infamously began with this sort of cord connecting these two women who are talking on the phone. So the premise is this kind of homey, chatty conversation. Ladies, have you heard? And it raises a whole set of questions about the Equal Rights Amendment, but begins with, are you sure you want to be liberated? You're told by reading that the Equal Rights Amendment would destroy the privileges, luxuries, and freedom of American women. And reiterated the argument that Phyllis Schlafly made that the Equal Rights Amendment would end protections of American wives. Now, these anti-ERA campaigns were actually highly effective in stirring up fear and anxiety. ERA supporters in Tennessee reported that they arrived at the legislature and that Schlafly's comments about the dangers to housewives had left, you know, all the women in the audience listening to her essentially shaking and quaking in their boots as they feared for the negative effects that supposedly were going to be an outcome of the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, supporters counter-argued to the claims that the Equal Rights Amendment would destroy the privileges of American housewives and homemakers. First, they noted that instead of privileges and special rights, feminists actually stressed the homemaker's lack of rights and precarious financial position. So precarious rather than protected was the true status of the homemaker, according to feminists. This, by the way, is a little bit later. It's 1979. It's a newspaper article about homemakers for the ERA. And there were housewives for the ERA, homemakers for the ERA organizations that appeared as early as the early 1970s. Actually, feminists were quite angry that Phyllis Schlafly claimed the high ground of caring about the housewife, because they had actually been thinking about the status of the homemaker long before Phyllis Schlafly ever took up the issue. And in fact, they had started with Phyllis Schlafly's fundamental premise that American homemakers actually had a lot of rights, that they were in a protected position. And for them, it was a kind of series of unraveling waves of shock and astonishment to discover how precarious homemakers and wives' positions were. For example, they learned that while there might be laws on the books that required husbands to support their wives, these were basically never enforced, and that courts were extremely reluctant to intervene in ongoing marriages. In cases of divorce, they also discovered that rights to alimony and child support were often actually not granted by courts. And even when they were granted by courts, women were often not receiving the money that they had been awarded. So as early as 1970, the head of NOW's Marriage and Divorce Committee called on women to do, she called it, junk the hearts and flowers approach and take a more pragmatic stance to prepare for the disasters that could overtake us. And in the 1970 National Conference for NOW, so again, we're 2 years even before the Equal Rights Amendment comes out of Congress, Now had passed a series of resolutions to rectify married women's vulnerability. And these had included calling for shared economic and household responsibilities, but they had also demanded a whole range of forms of insurance for divorced wives. So they wanted divorced wives to be eligible for pensions, health insurance, Social Security. So concerns for the housewife had been on the agenda for feminist activists as soon as the movement got underway. But by 1975, housewives began to preoccupy Equal Rights Amendment campaigners. There were a series of disappointing defeats in 1975 that led ERA activists to kind of refocus their strategy. So Betty Friedan would say that while lies were spread by ERA opponents, they fed real fears of women. And Friedan argued that now needed to respond in a more straightforward way to the fears of these women and get an access route that is more relevant to the lives of women at home, she would say. So in Illinois, for example, housewives for ERA, they were outraged. Stop ERA, Illinois was kind of ground zero for Stop ERA. So housewives for ERA in Illinois were facing some of the most active anti-ERA networks. Housewives for ERA educated voters, they lobbied state legislators, and when Stop ERA came to the state legislature with home-baked bread, Housewives for ERA countered with signs that said, homemakers are more than bread makers. And they would send legislators letters saying that housewives weren't simply bread makers, but were family makers. And they argued that by granting women's equal legal status, the Equal Rights Amendment would actually strengthen families and give dignity to the role of wife and mother. And in 1978, the National Organization for Women actually passed a Homemakers Bill of Rights. So who'd have thought that the people spent so much time thinking about and caring about homemakers in the height of the 1970s? So they start whereas society has not recognized the economic value of the goods and services provided by the homemaker to her or his family and the community. So they start with a fundamental premise about the economic contributions of homemakers to supporting and sustaining families. And in fact, feminists across this period did various kinds of calculations about how much you would have to pay people to provide all the services that homemakers provided. And it ranged from like a few thousand dollars to, in one calculation, $30,000 a year. They go on to say this lack of economic value has resulted not only in the evaluation of homemakers as, quote, non-working women, but also has deprived the homemaker of job-related benefits that paid workers take for granted. So they continually frame the homemaker's position as the position as like a worker and look at what it's like to be a person working in the home and argue that such women face serious disabilities. And they go on then to resolve a whole host of things down there. And I've actually, just to for clarifications, to let you know that I've cut it short a little bit here and I've left out some of the resolutions. So they argue here, for example, at the end of that line, homemakers should be granted the recognition and rights of paid skilled workers. They argue for independent Social Security coverage in a spouse's own name, portable into and out of marriage. So, for example, a number of laws on the books in this period meant that at divorce, if you hadn't been married for long enough, you lost whatever Social Security you had accrued through your husband, because as a homemaker, you accrued Social Security benefits through your husband. So they wanted a more guaranteed basis for homemaker Social Security coverage. They want disability and retirement benefits. They want the inclusion of the value of the goods and services counted in the gross national product. So they want to essentially grant large-scale national public recognition of homemakers' labor through this kind of fundamental economic calculus. And then finally, they argue for development of flexible time and part-time employment in order to enable women to be caring for children as well as and homemaking as well as wage earning. Now's president told Congress in May 1979 that just as the GI Bill enacted after World War II had granted veterans various subsidies and recognition of their services, this Bill of Rights guaranteed homemakers would be rewarded for their years of service with support for education and workforce reentry. So through the whole second half of the ratification campaign for the Equal Rights Amendment, now affirmed the ERA's relevance for homemakers and challenged Schlafly's claims, arguing that the Equal Rights Amendment would guarantee justice on the job for women, both in the marketplace and in the home. Okay, so why was the housewife the focus of the Equal Rights Amendment battle? It seems like something of an odd direction for the debate to go in. Across the 1970s, many commentators believed that the housewife was what they called a dying breed. People called her an endangered species, a diminishing breed. They thought that in the 1970s, we were witnessing essentially the last generation of a type that would be no more. And in fact, statistics confirmed the downward trend in homemaking. As early as 1975, just 34 of 100 husband-wife families had a breadwinner husband and a wife homemaker. So we're down to 34 out of 100 families built on the traditional female homemaker, male breadwinner model. As the 1980s dawned, the Boston Globe reported with a headline, "The Housewife, a New Minority," and they declared the housewife a vanishing breed and worried about the civil rights of the country's latest minority, the housewife. That is, women who stayed at home, as women who stayed at home were outnumbered by women in the labor force. Now, needless to say, as you all know, the homemaker did not disappear. But in debating homemakers' precarious position, Americans were actually arguing about whether maternal wage earning should transform American families in the face of a new economy. So debate about the fate of the housewife was intimately tied to new economic realities emerging in the 1970s. A recession began in 1973 that would turn the American economy in new directions. Unemployment would rise across the decade, as would inflation at the same time, leading to something that was called stagflation, something that economists never really expected, to have both high unemployment and high inflation in the same period. Faltering productivity in the American economy, along with greater international competition, triggered plant closings and layoffs across the 1970s. Male wages began a decades-long slide in real terms. So male wages, on average, began to go down. At the same time, the service sector came of age. By 1984, service sector employment accounted for about three quarters of domestic employment. Okay, now these shifts in the economy made employment of homemakers of pressing concern. As inflation rose, wages went less far. As men's jobs seemed more and more threatened because of closing factories and other plants, women's employment seemed more and more necessary. So people began to argue that the single paycheck family, as they called it, was going the way of the dinosaur, that essentially the single paycheck family was becoming extinct. And in fact, the people who would become employed in order to manage this economic pressure were married, middle-aged women. As more and more jobs opened up in the service sector, these are the kinds of jobs that married women had the skills for and were able to move into. Between 1970 and 1984, so between in those 14 years, three-fifths of all new jobs went to women. So women outpaced men in taking jobs in this new economy. So families were essentially facing all kinds of economic pressures and responding to those economic pressures by moving women into the paid labor forces. Now, conservatives and liberals had very different responses to these economic shifts. Conservatives argued that it was necessary to protect the housewife role and to protect male breadwinners, while liberals countered by trying to secure economic security for what they called displaced homemakers. Okay, so here's Phyllis. There's the ubiquitous Stop ERA. This is near the end. She's talking about the end of an era. So she says this is a triumphant moment for Schlafly. So Schlafly would comment on these new economic circumstances, writing in the Phyllis Schlafly Report in May 1975 that unemployment had reached 8.9%, its highest point since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Job prospects, she would say, were dimmer than ever before for men because of rising competition from women entering the job market. Schlafly called it discrimination against husbands, and she attacked feminists for what she said they were doing. They were making a concerted drive on men in their role as family provider. Schlafly went on to support preferential hiring for family breadwinners, and she opposed any regulations that would have limited an employer from asking a prospective applicant about their marital status. To prevent employers from preferring breadwinner fathers in hiring created what she called reverse discrimination against men in their role as providers. So a parallel right that Schlafly articulates in this moment to the right of a woman to be a full-time homemaker, she describes what she calls a man's right and ability to fulfill his role as provider. So Schlafly responds to this kind of dangerous economic situation, this emerging threat to families' ability to sustain full-time homemakers, with a call for legal support for male breadwinners. She wants favoritism for hiring men who are husbands and fathers in jobs. She wants to discriminate effectively against women and mothers in favor of men and fathers. Now, liberals would contend, first of all, that housewives economic contributions were not being recognized, so that we simply needed to acknowledge the labor that women were performing in the home. Housewives were workers, and they agreed that recognition of the economic value of a homemaker's labor would be a fundamental gain brought about by the ERA. Secondly, feminists contended that women who were being dislocated from the home by these economic forces needed support. And they led a strikingly effective grassroots campaign for disabled, displaced homemakers. This is a newsletter of a Milwaukee women's organization, and they have here organized, begun a displaced homemakers program. I'm going to pass around. This was the kind of rallying call book that was published, I think it's 1980 is the date for it, Displaced Homemakers, Organizing for a New Life. It's 1981. The displaced homemaker movement was a strikingly effective grassroots campaign on behalf of what activists called displaced homemakers. Displaced homemakers were women who had spent their lives primarily as homemakers and were being pushed out of the home by a variety of forces. Most important among them for these activists were divorce, but they also included separation and widowhood, disability of husbands, women who had devoted themselves to caring for families, but were now facing economic vulnerability. So displaced homemaker programs started first at the state level in California in 1975, and finally received national recognition in 1978 when funding was given to displaced homemaker programs through the Comprehensive Education and Training Act. And displaced homemaker programs did much the same thing as displaced worker legislation in the same period. So in the very same years that Congress was enacting legislation for displaced homemakers, they were also enacting legislation for displaced workers, that is, workers who had lost their jobs in factories as a consequence of foreign competition. Okay, so displaced homemaker programs provided counseling for women, education, job preparation, resume writing skills, job training, and even preparation for non-traditional employment. Activists behind the displaced homemaker program essentially saw it in market terms. They saw their responsibility as facilitating women's protection by enabling them to compete successfully in the waged marketplace. So, with feminists conceptualizing housewives as workers, and conservatives seeking to retain male breadwinning, in the fate of the housewife hung the balance of gender roles and the course of change that would follow the new economic realities. Now, historians have offered a variety of explanations for the Equal Rights Amendment's failures, other than the one I'm offering you here. Sometimes they explain the failure of the Equal Rights Amendment as a consequence of recalcitrant state legislators. This was an argument that feminists in particular made in the very bitter years in the aftermath of the ERA's defeat. They argued that a few misogynistic state legislators, male state legislators in southern legislatures, had held the country hostage by refusing to support the ERA in spite of broad support across the country. Another argument is one that compares the effectiveness of pro and anti movements. So they argue that the pro-ERA activists were less effective than the anti-ERA activists. The antis had a very highly motivated and brilliantly mobilized grassroots campaign that was well organized in key states that were debating the passage of the amendment. The pro-ERA activists, on the other hand, were professionalized. They were somewhat more distant. They tended to be operating from national headquarters in Washington rather than a kind of mobilized grassroots network. Yet, I would argue that these explanations ultimately don't capture the deeper conflict behind the ERA. The ERA across the 1970s became a focus of contention over the reorganization of social relations in the new economy. And nowhere is this more evident than in the 1977 National Women's Conference. And this is a slide of women marching into the National Women's Conference, which was held in Houston in November 1977. It's remembered by those who were there as a kind of great moment of triumph. And in fact, actually, I have, this is the book that came out of it, and there's some other wonderful pictures you can look at. The National Women's Conference had been 2 years in the planning when feminists first prompted Congress to have some kind of official American commemoration of International Women's Year in 1975. And for 2 years, they had held state-level conventions and meetings and developed what was called the National Plan of Action. And finally, in November 1977, 2,005 official delegates arrived in Houston's Convention Center. As the convention opened, there were three hot-button issues which dominated news coverage of the convention. The first was the Equal Rights Amendment. The second was abortion, because by 1977, we are now 4 years after the Roe v. Wade decision, and abortion had become increasingly contentious politically. And finally, the third hot button issue was recognizing the rights of lesbians. Yet, homemakers were front and center at the conference. As pro-plan, the people who supported the National Plan of Action were called pro-plan, feminist activists dueled with pro-family activists who gathered across town. Pro-family was a term that was invented in the context of the National Women's Conference. They called themselves for the first time the pro-family movement as they organized a counter rally to the Women's Convention. At the official convention, Bella Abzug, there she is, front and center with her, she always wears this hat, spoke before the assembled delegates. And when she asked the audience to raise their hands if they were homemakers, so you have this 2005 women sitting in front of her, more than two-thirds of the hands went up. So clearly, women on the floor of the convention both understood homemaker to be a politicized term and identified with it for themselves. Bella Abzug declared to the convention that this nation could not function for a day if the millions of women who work exclusively in the home were to stop doing what they do. Yet, without objective value, measuring their what she called sun-up to sundown labor, homemakers were at a serious disadvantage in the country's laws. So pro-plan activists saw themselves working for homemaking as well as wage-earning women. And in fact, there was an official homemaker plank, was one of the 26 planks that were endorsed by the conference. And the homemaker plank in the national plan called for more equitable alimony and economic arrangements at divorce, but never assumed that women would receive permanent support as a homemaker. Now, across town, we can leave. I lost my slide, that's all right. Across town, Phyllis Schlafly, who had been organizing conference opposition for nearly a year, saw in the conference not the validation and inclusion of homemakers' concerns, but actually disregard of their status and of their needs. So Schlafly spoke on at the Astro Arena, where opponents had organized a counter rally. 11,000 people packed that arena. They spilled into the aisles. Several thousand more listened outside. Phyllis Schlafly's speech was ERA, an attack on the family. Schlafly roused the crowd with blunt enunciations of the ERA as an anti-family amendment, and reiterated her kind of, for the millionth time, basically, that the ERA takes the wife out of the home and away from her family. And audiences responded in just enormously enthusiastically to Schlafly's speech. And there are some wonderful quotes from reporters moving through the crowd. Young women with children in baby carriages, just very much the same kind of women we were talking about before, talking about how Schlafly spoke for them, how she recognized their concerns and the dilemmas they faced in caring for the children. At the official conference itself, there was a minority report to the broader national plan, and the minority report bemoaned those who downgraded the role of homemaker. So while it was less noticed in the media than conflicts over abortion and lesbianism, the nonstop discussion of the homemaker at the National Women's Conference was more significant in the long run. It was a fight over the birth of the modern working family. The debate about the ERA then happened at the cross currents of economic and social change, in a moment in which the homemaker herself seemed like she was about to disappear. And the male breadwinner household, particularly one that was led by an old-fashioned blue-collar worker, seemed less and less a social reality. So the Equal Rights Amendment failed because it seemed to intensify or even potentially be blamed as a cause for a set of socioeconomic changes that were deeply troubling and very much in process across the 1970s. Now, scholars, of course, have noticed the conflict over gender roles that were so prominent in the ERA debate. But it's important to acknowledge that it was not simply changes in gender roles that were at stake, but a fight over the homemaker's fate more generally in the battle over the ERA. There were additionally sort of more complex roots than simply whether women should be homemakers or whether they should have choice to be wage earners. Actually, it's a deeper conflict about the structural changes in the economy that brought more and more wives and mothers into the paid labor force and weakened industrial employment among men. So the Equal Rights Amendment struggle represented battling visions about a state-endorsed family system in this new reality. Would the state uphold the traditional male breadwinner family, or would it support the all-adult breadwinner family? And for those fighting over the Equal Rights Amendment, increasingly it came to seem that at the very heart of the debate about the Equal Rights Amendment was this question about which side would the state come down on. Would it go on in the direction of upholding America's traditions, or would it, by endorsing the Equal Rights Amendment, be advocating for a new kind of family form that was seeming increasingly necessary in the new economy? So the ERA foundered on the question of the housewife. Now, there was, of course, broad consensus on support for women's rights. Women should get equal pay at their jobs. They should have a right to be employed if they wanted to be employed. They should have a right to go to whatever educational programs they wanted to go to. Phyllis Schlafly, in fact, endorsed all of these goals herself. Yet there was no consensus at all about changes in family roles and about social expectations for men and women in the labor force. Now, the Equal Rights Amendment did not pass. But the new economy would, in fact, push resolution of this debate about the fate of the housewife over the course of the new next decades, as working families became the national norm. So today, in fact, we live with the all breadwinner family for the vast majorities of American households, and we do not live with the male breadwinner model that Phyllis Schlafly sought to endorse. Yet, in spite of that changed social reality, we still live with the thorny dilemma on which the Equal Rights Amendment foundered of how to value and support the family labor long performed by the housewife. So you guys, so I'm going to stop and say thank you very much and call class officially to a conclusion. And thank you for coming. And but don't go anywhere.
Next week on Lectures in History, Clemson University professor Vernon Burton discusses the idea of Southern identity. The class examines the history and culture of the American South, from colonial times through the Civil War and Reconstruction to the 1960s Civil Rights era and up to the modern day. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts. Or download them from iTunes.